To be American is to drink. To be American is to worry about drinking. Those are the opening lines of Zero Proof, a recipe book that traces the history of temperance in the United States and the recent rise of the non-alcoholic beverage. Our guest says the combination of drinking and socializing is woven into the fabric of our nation, but Americans are starting to renegotiate their relationship with alcohol, whether that means participating in Dry January, cutting back on alcoholic drinks throughout the week, or abstaining from it altogether. Today on Food Friday, we're celebrating the non-alcoholic drink with recipes and advice to help create NA cocktails at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you drink mocktails at a bar at home? What's your take on the rise of non-alcoholic drink options? Have you tried NA beers, or there's a lot of new spirits out there, even some wines alcohol-free? Join in at 800-642-1234. And have you been in that situation, maybe here in Wisconsin, where you're the only one not drinking? You feel like you're the odd one out? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elva Ramirez is a wine and spirits journalist. She's the author of the book Zero Proof, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. Elva, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Let's talk about the word we're using to talk about what we talk about. Mocktails. You know, people used to call them that. I say I make myself mocktails. A lot of people are moving away from that word, though, especially in the bartender world. Why is that?
You know, a lot of people don't know this, but according to Merriam-Webster, mocktail actually first shows up in the dictionary in 1916, which is a few years just before Prohibition. So it's been with us for that long. But when I was researching the book, I saw that when I looked at news databases, mocktail was around during Prohibition and certainly after, but people really start using it in the 1980s. When there was this move to curb drunk driving among teenagers. And so there were a lot of mocktail contests to encourage people to drink less. And that's where you start getting the popularity of mocktails. And that's actually where it gets its terrible reputation, because bartenders at the time had lost touch with the elegance of craft cocktails. The craft cocktail world wasn't with us yet. And so when you look at the things that were winning contests at the time, it's things like two scoops of vanilla ice cream and orgeat and, you know, soda and whipped cream and simple syrup. So it's just like a ton of sugar. They really didn't represent cocktails in the way we think of them now. So that's where it gets its bad reputation. But things have been changing now. And sometimes bartenders point out that they don't like the word mocktail because mock means both fake. And mock also means to make fun of. And so they want to put their guests first, and they don't like that word. I personally don't, I don't correct anyone when they say if they want to call it a mocktail, if that's what you want to call it, like, have fun, it's great. I prefer zero proof, and sometimes bartenders use spirit free or temperance. I think everything's fine. The last thing I'll say about mocktail is that it's very much of a time and place, in the same way that disco music, it represents a specific era and a specific production values. But disco as electronic dance music has never left. It's always been with us. It just has changed style and it's changed production values. We call it different things now. We might call it house or techno or electronica, but it's still there. And so the mocktail in the same way has always been with us. It has just always changed names and changed the personality in some way, and certainly has changed production values.
And in your research for your book, you traveled the world, really, and it seems like there's been this boom in interest in zero proof drinks, but also in the creativity that people are putting into creating them. What is driving this?
Well, you know, almost every great bartender now is an expert in everything, right? So every bartender now is a whiskey expert. They are a mezcal expert. They can talk to you everything about tequila and production that goes into very specific spirits. And so the non-alcoholic drink really represents like the vanguard of a new way of them to flex. And it's very culinary inspired. It allows them to do a lot of things. A metaphor I use sometimes is if you have a French trained chef and you ask them to make you something vegan, they're not going to not make you something great. They're just, you know, not going to use dairy or beef, right? And a really talented bartenders the same way. If you ask them to make something non-alcoholic, they're still going to have all their tools, all their bag of tricks, and they're still going to come up with something that's very exciting. And so for a lot of bartenders, they see this as a new challenge, a way to sort of show off their flavor combinations and their different techniques. You just can't use booze, but you're still going to get something that's very thoughtful and carefully crafted.
Now, Wisconsin has a pretty big drinking culture, and I've heard from people over the years, you know, you feel weird when you're in the group of people drinking alcohol and you're the one not drinking. I think that might be changing some. Can you talk about that kind of inclusive part of providing these delicious non-alcoholic beverages for people? They get to play, they get to join in and not be the odd one out.
Absolutely. You know, that theme, that the idea of like, I don't want to drink, but then I don't want to be the weird one left out. That goes back, honestly, centuries, right? Like in my research, that goes all the way back to the colonies, and we see it a lot in Prohibition and certainly in the 1950s. Just a quick story. I saw this news article from the 1960s from Chicago, where a bartender said that during these, like the Mad Men era, executives would come up and, you know, pay the bartender a ton of money ahead of time to fill a vodka bottle with water so that they would just get poured water all night because they didn't want to have to, they couldn't drink and socialize and do their jobs. So this anxiety about still having to be social, but not be singled out, has been with us for a long time. And the popularity of these new products and the popularity of the non-alcoholic space is the fact that the companies and bartenders and consumers are finally recognizing that it's okay not to drink, that you don't have to feel weird. And like, there's ways to make people comfortable. And one of the interesting ways is that you create a cocktail that looks the same, right? That's going to be made with a really great ingredients. It's going to be presented in a great glass. It's not going to be a pint glass, you know, that just looks like water. It's not going to be, clear. It might be clear, but it doesn't have to look boring. It doesn't have to look like everyone has, you know, their wonderful martini glasses and you're the one holding just like a pint glass of water. That's what we're trying to get away from. In the same way, I'll add that, you know, years ago, friends who are vegetarian or vegan, you know, they would be giving a hard time when they went to restaurants. The kitchen would be like, I don't know, do you want carrots? Like, people would be giving a hard time if they wanted something that was vegan. But now that's not the way anymore. Now it's accepted, or it's expected, I have to say, that you're going to have to have multiple options for people with vegan or vegetarian preferences. I would say that we're going to see the same thing with non-alcoholic drinks. It's not there yet, but that's where it's going.
It's Food Friday. We are making some non-alcoholic cocktails. Alva Ramirez is with us, author of the book Zero Proof, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with non-alcoholic cocktails. If you have one you like, if you've encountered one out in the wild, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in River Falls. Randy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Great subject today. I'm listening intently because I don't drink a lot anymore. I'm a little bit older. I did plenty of drinking when I was young. Never drank and drove, so I did a lot of designated driving, and I still do that. So, but I've at home now been experimenting with some mock drinks, different versions of Bloody Marys, ice cream drinks, sour drinks. I've really kind of really enjoyed, but you know, I'm really looking at all kinds of different ingredients and things, and really enthused about all the media on going to these different drinks.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Well, let's start to get practical. He mentioned that Bloody Mary territory, Alva. What kind of things have you encountered out there as you talk to bartenders about how they make a good non-alcoholic Bloody Mary style drink?
You know, what's funny is that in my research, there's actually an article that I found in a women's magazine that, to modern eyes, to our eyes, is a Bloody Mary recipe. And it was originally in this particular magazine. It was published as a non-alcoholic drink because it was published during Prohibition. And this predates what we consider to be the birth of the Bloody Mary at the King Cole Bar in New York a few years later. So actually, the Bloody Mary was always non-alcoholic. But what I love about this idea of the Bloody Mary and Randy's comment is this idea of savory, because sometimes people assume quite rightly, that a lot of non-alcoholic drinks are, they're made with fresh juices, they're sweet, and they are, some can be, absolutely. But there's really a lot of room to play with this idea of savory. Bitter is actually really great, because things that are savory and bitter force you to slow down and force you to sip. You're not going to drink it all at once, although that's nice too. But a savory complex drink with a lot of layers will kind of allow you to kind of really enjoy that moment. So you can do a lot with the first thing if someone were to say, oh, you know, how can I make a really great Bloody Mary? I would say, think of it like, you know, it's cooking, right? It's culinary. Think about things like dehydrated mushrooms that you would let steep for a really long time. So that you're making a really kind of dense mushroom tea, and then you're using that as the base, to, you know, to begin something like a Bloody Mary. There's a Will Wyatt, who used to be at Lone Madison Park and now is at Mr. Paradise in New York, gave me a really wonderful recipe in for the book, where he makes a mushroom tea. He also makes a dashi with clarified tomato. So you can do a lot of things where, even if you have the Bloody Mary, if you try running it through like coffee filters, for example, and you take the pulp out and you get something that's just like very, very clear, you're going to get something that's going to remind you a little bit of a savory martini. That can be really, really fun. You can do a lot with that.
Thanks a lot for that call. And that reminds me, speaking of savory type drinks, you shared a couple of recipes with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. The Medina Night. Now, this is a carrot juice based drink. Can you tell us about this one?
Yes. One second. I'm pulling up on the page right now, just so I can have it correct. So this came from Sam Johnson at Death & Co., which is a really, it's like, if you know New York City, you know bars. Death & Co. is one of the top bars in New York City, and they actually have other locations as well. So this one completely caught me off guard when he made it. It's wonderfully vibrant. You know, if you've had fresh carrot juice, you know that it has this like really beautiful sweetness and earthiness to it. So it does catch you off guard. This is one of those drinks where you look at the ingredients and you recognize everything. You say, okay, it has carrot juice, has fresh lemon juice, has ginger syrup, a little bit of orange juice and honey. And you go, oh, I know all those flavors. But when you put it together and you shake it up, you kind of go, oh, this is, I wasn't expecting that. And so what's really great about this drink is that it has a bit of complexity to it. It comes together really easily, but the carrot juice, you know, gives it this lovely earthiness and a gorgeous color. You know, orange juice is giving you a little bit of sweetness. Ginger is going to give you a little bit of heat, and honey, of course, is sweet. It's a really wonderful brunch drink. I discovered it because he made it during my friend's, what do you call it? I'm blanking, baby shower. Sorry, I forgot what it's called for a second. He made it during my friend's baby shower, and it was an absolute hit.
Talking to Alva Ramirez, wine and spirits writer, author of the book Zero Proof. On this edition of Food Friday, she's serving up advice for making great non-alcoholic cocktails for your next happy hour or baby shower. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite mixed drink when you're not drinking alcohol, whether you never drink it or you want? I do this a lot. I want a cocktail. I want booze right now. I like having something that meets that category, doesn't have the alcohol in it. If you have a favorite one, if you've encountered great ones at restaurants or bars, or terrible ones at restaurants or bars, we want to hear about it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking with Alva Ramirez, author of Zero Proof, 90 non-alcoholic recipes for mindful drinking. We're mixing up some great non-alcoholic cocktails. Whether you call it a mocktail or zero proof or spirit-free, it's all about making a great mixed drink without alcohol. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to mad scientist this at home like I do sometimes? What have you come up with? What are some of your hits and misses? What makes you want to drink non-alcoholic cocktails? I get it. Why do you do it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Alva, a few of our commenters on Facebook have brought up part of the social side of this. Brandy writes, when I didn't order a drink, people used to ask if I was pregnant, which was really hard because I'd had losses. This is before I could do in vitro fertilization. But now it's no big deal. And you hammer this point home, Elva, in your book. If people say, hey, yeah, I don't want an alcoholic drink, we don't need to interrogate them as to why, right?
Absolutely. And you never have to explain yourself in the same way that we never, you know, we don't go out, you don't go out with your vegetarian friends and pressure them to eat chicken. Like we don't do that anymore. And so I'm hoping that the same care comes to the non-alcoholic drink. And I sort of feel that pain, and you know, of being, there's an assumption that something's wrong. And, you know, that really kind of dates back to, that's very ingrained. It goes back to, the idea of why we drink and what happens when we drink. It's a lot of things. This is not a new thing. This goes back, honestly, centuries. If you look at drinking culture and people are fearful of things that are others. If you, everyone's drinking, you're not, it's suspicious, even if they don't come out and say that. And so ideally we're going to get past that someday. But the few ways around that is to, you can order drinks now and you can look at the menu, and there's usually a lot of restaurants will have a menu where they will have non-alcoholic drinks highlighted. And when you order this, you'll get a pretty drink in a pretty glass, and then you don't stand out. Right. That's the ideal, that you can look across the room and you don't have to, it looks like everyone's holding pretty cocktails, so you can't tell what's what. That's the point that we're going to get to. You know, we're getting there. Sometimes we still have bumps in the road, but I'm hoping to get there, and I'm hoping that a lot of this comes from training. I'll say bartenders are great, but sometimes even bartenders will make that assumption, or waiters, you know, if you ask, oh, I'm not drinking yet, they'll say, oh, what's wrong? Like, why not? I haven't gotten that, but my friends have gotten that and told me about it. And it's, especially if you're a woman, it feels a little bit invasive. So I also hope that this is not just based, you know, the burden is not just on the consumer. I'm hoping that there's a lot of training that happens in hospitality where they're training the staff to not make assumptions about why someone doesn't want to drink.
We also heard from Carol on Facebook, who writes, I do not drink alcohol by choice. I've never had any problems in ordering drinks. Last week, I had a refreshing lemonade, orange juice, and Sprite beverage, while others had tequila in theirs. All right, more power to you, Carol. But I got to say, Elva, I generally want not a mixed drink minus the alcohol. I want something to fulfill some of the, I guess, the burn, some of the bitter in some cases. I use bitters, which has a tiny bit of booze. You're using a couple drops there. Sometimes a little iced tea gives that like a bitter base. You mentioned that steeping the mushrooms. What are some of the other things that people do to fill a little bit of that void when you take alcohol out of that mixed drink?
You know, while I was writing this book right before the boom in the brands, the non-alcoholic brands happened. So my book has a lot of original recipes. It doesn't have a lot of products, but I was able to put some products in there. And if I had written the book a year after, it would have changed. So to answer your question in one way, there's a whole new, like just so many new brands that can really help with that, and that really take that idea of like, oh, when we drink, we do like that burn. And there's just really fantastic products. Ritual, Zero Proof, which is based out of Chicago, is fantastic. And Marcus, the CEO, designed that when his wife was pregnant and he wanted to like not drink in solidarity with her. And as he was mixing things up, he was like, no, I want this burn. And so Ritual has like they come through it with a little bit of depending on the they have different flavors, but they'll do things like add pepper, for example, to give you that burn. So there's Ritual's great, C-Lip is great. And in terms of bitterness, there's these non-alcoholic sodas. There's so many now of these bitter Amaro sodas. They're in the style of the Italian Amaro sodas that you see in Europe. Casamara Club, which is based out of Brooklyn, they are absolutely fantastic. And they really have a complex, bitter profile that is immensely satisfying, that you don't miss the alcohol in that, because it has layers. And that's really the key to a really good cocktail, like even just a regular cocktail, a traditional, let's just talk about a traditional, like old fashioned, for example. We like that because when we drink it, it has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a finish. And it sits with you for a long time. And so for a long time, the non-alcoholic drink, when it was made with just juice, it's just one note. There's not much to it. And once you drink it, it's gone. And so with these non-alcoholic brands, a lot of these new liqueurs, and like I said, these sparkling sodas, they're really thinking about what's satisfying in a drink. And what's satisfying in a drink is a beginning, middle, and end, and a finish. And so that's one way of approximating that sort of pleasure we get from having, say, whiskey. It's to have something that lingers longer than that last sip.
Now, you have 90 recipes in this book. I'm sure you've tried many more. Is there one, or are there one or two non-alcoholic cocktails, Elva, that have become just part of your regular life that you just loved so much that they're your thing now?
There is one. It's not on the list here, but there's actually the ones that you're listing on your website are absolutely fantastic. I'd love to talk about the Grove and Tonic, but the one I remember that I was talking about was so simple. It was came from my friend at Le Syndicat, which is one of the top bars in Paris. And it's so simple. It's basically you steep lemon verbena and chamomile, and no, sorry, lemon verbena and lavender overnight. Just let it sit with some water and some sugar. You strain out the solids after the fact. So then you basically have this like sweet cordial. And then we add tonic to it and we add kombucha. So we add kombucha and some lemon juice, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Every time I have a party, I make it. It's more or less three steps. It's shocking how delicious it is. It's in my book. But the one that's on the website right now is called Grove and Tonic. And this is a really pretty one because the secret to this one is that you're making rose ice cubes. So the drink is going to be pink, and then it's going to change color as you have these pink, like these rose, they're basically made with peach tea. So you basically make tea and then you let it freeze. And then when you make your drink and put it all together, you're going to put the ice cubes in the drink and everything's going to change color over time.
That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to our Food Friday guest, Elva Ramirez, author of the book Zero Proof. Find that recipe she was just talking about and another one, too, for this carrot-based drink at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can keep sharing your non-alcoholic cocktail stories, preferences, hits and misses over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the weekly news roundup with a look at indictments against fake electors in Michigan and a possible third-party presidential effort in the works. Those stories and more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, President Biden is out with a new change to student loan repayment plans. That comes after the U.S. Supreme Court last month overturned his previous attempt to eliminate around $400 billion in debt for more than 40 million Americans. The Biden administration says the Saving on Valuable Education, or SAVE, plan will lower monthly payments for people with student loan debt down to $0 in some cases. We're taking a look at the plan, how it works, who would be eligible, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have student loans? How has the restarting of payments affected you? Were you in a little back and forth over the previous plan that got taken down by the U.S. Supreme Court? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we last talked to you pretty much right after the U.S. Supreme Court took down that other Biden administration student loan debt forgiveness plan. This is pretty different, but for some people it might accomplish something similar. Can you give us the broad strokes? What is this thing?
It is an income-driven repayment plan. And what that means is that monthly student loan payments will be connected to the amount of income that somebody who has loans earns. And so basically it reduces your monthly payment, allows for some cancellation that comes sooner than some of the older plans. And the idea is that this will be done automatically for people who are currently repaying their loans in an income-driven repayment plan.
Right. So an income-driven repayment plan could mean, hey, while you're making less money now, you have lower payments, but you still have to pay the whole thing off eventually as your income goes up. You mentioned there is some forgiveness built into this. It's a little more complicated than, you know, waving a magic wand and taking a number off of your total debt. How does that part of it work?
That's right. So these income-driven plans require borrowers to make payments for 10 years, in some cases 20 or even 25 years. And so the older income-driven plans, those are called income contingent repayment, income-based repayment, and pay as you earn. These are very specific programs that have been created over time. Those programs all have a forgiveness of 20 or 25 years. If you're in those payments plans and you're making payments, eventually those loans will be canceled after several years. There are some ifs and contingencies here, but this new save plan replaces one of them and says, okay, after 10 years, we're going to start forgiving certain debts.
Who is eligible for that kind of, you know, the lower rates of payment and that earlier forgiveness?
Well, that's the big question. So on one hand, we have folks who are currently repaying through one of these income-driven plans. They're going to automatically be moved over to the save plan. So for many people, they don't have to do anything except for maybe recertify when you know they have to. And that old plan is called the revised pay-as-you-earn plan. So there's so much jargon and so much complexity to this. It's hard to kind of explain. But basically, you have one group of folks who will be kind of grandfathered in because they're already in a plan. Then the other group of folks who are not yet in a plan will have to apply. And when they do, they can be eligible for payments that are going to be tied to their income. And sometimes it could be $0 a month that you owe.
I want to be real practical here. Suppose somebody's listening. They have student loan debt. It was the payments were postponed during COVID. Under the Biden plan, they would have seen some of it forgiven. That's gone away now because of the Supreme Court. They aren't making a ton of money, so they think they might be eligible. What do they do? Do they go? They can't apply yet, but when this kicks in, how do they apply? What do we know about that? Or does it just happen?
You'll have to apply if you're not already in the system, basically. So when you apply, you go to the federal U.S. Department of Education's website. You make an application. You can do all this through your loan servicer. That loan servicer is a company that that's the one that you make your payments to every month. And between the parties, you'll be able to make your application and get into this repayment plan. And then you have to have undergraduate direct loans or graduate direct loans. And those are very specific terms that are federal loans. So if you, for example, borrowed from a bank or a credit union or some other private entity, those would not qualify. It has to be a federal direct loan.
Talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at a new student loan debt repayment rule from the Biden administration that allows lower payments, sometimes as low as zero, and the potential for earlier forgiveness. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. Thank you for taking my phone call and happy Friday. Okay. My son is a graduate of the UW system. He's got a master's and he's got a huge pile of student debt. My problem is when you buy a house or you buy a car, you take out a loan and you're expected to pay that money back. He took out a loan and he realizes that yes, he has to pay that money back. I'm sorry, I know this probably sounds mean, but I don't think that it's fair that they're gonna say, oh, okay, we'll let you go.
Pat, I gotcha. And Pat's not alone, Nick. Concerns about fairness, not just compared to other kinds of loans, but to someone who, you know, has already paid off a student loan or found other means to pay. That's been a concern with this talk of student loan debt forgiveness all along, right?
That's absolutely right. And there have been over the years, not just under the Biden administration, but under conservative and more liberal administrations over the years, there have been a lot of interest in public service loan forgiveness. So folks who go into public services like teaching or nurses or so on, or work with a nonprofit organization, these jobs typically don't pay a whole lot, but you need a college degree to work in those positions. There have been some carve outs over time for these loan forgiveness plans for people who are in the public sector. And so, yes, there are definitely politics here and issues of fairness, And there are also kind of like protected groups that policymakers have over time tried to benefit. And we see now in the current debates, it's not just about public service loan forgiveness. It's bigger than that now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. With the public service loan forgiveness, a related story here. There's been reporting from NPR over the last bunch of years that people who probably should be eligible for that kind of debt forgiveness aren't getting it, largely because of red tape. The Biden administration also making a push to get more people who thought they were going to get debt forgiveness because of that public service you mentioned actually get it. What are you watching for there, Nick?
That's right. There are two parts to this. One, you're absolutely right. This public service loan forgiveness has gone through a lot of fixes over the past couple of years. And I looked up some data for the state of Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, probably about a year and a half or 2 years ago, there have been almost 10,000 individual borrowers who have had their debts forgiven under this public service loan forgiveness plan. And so that's on one hand of the equation. That totals to about $600 some million. And on the other hand, you have some other cancellation that the Biden administration has been working on for students who have gone to a college and that college defrauded them. There are many colleges out there, too many, that promise a particular career path, or they promise a particular experience and you don't get it. And in these cases, it's possible to have the college defraud students. And under certain circumstances, you can have your loans forgiven if you were defrauded. And so in Wisconsin, about 200 applications have been approved for this borrower defense cancellation, and that's another $41 million. There's been another recent fix that canceled even more. So there will be these targeted approaches that affect people in Wisconsin here and there.
Let's go back to our callers. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the program. Yes, I would have to say that I would disagree with the previous caller. It's one thing if you are able to finance your education with the subsidized federal loans. Typically, the interest rates is lower, and then you don't start paying interest until you get out of college. But those other loans that the interest rates are higher, and you start paying interest immediately, and then you pay interest on interest. You've heard those horrible stories about people who are paying on their loans their whole lives and never get them paid off. I mean, part of the difficulty is that we are not investing in education as a state. We're 47 or 43 out of the 50 United States. I mean, it's really a crisis. I work in higher ed. I have for almost 20 years. And when you talk to students who are paying 9% interest, and this was at the time when
rates were lower. Christine, I gotcha. I want to give Nick a quick moment before you take a break. Nick, your thoughts on what Christine brought up?
Oh, totally right. Interest capitalization is a big problem with some of the existing income-driven repayment plans, and that has created payments to balloon and the debt to balloon for a lot of borrowers. And this new SAVE program is designed to stop that from happening. One of the features of this new SAVE program we haven't talked about yet is that it ends interest capitalization. So your loan will not continue to balloon if you're in this program.
Thanks for the call, Christine. Talking to Nick Hillman with UW-Madison, getting an update on student loans, repayments restarting, the latest on the Biden administration's SAVE plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or experiences. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nick Hillman, professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison, looking at student loans and the Biden administration's latest attempts at offering some level of loan forgiveness. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Minnesota. Josh, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I had a question. So my wife has a significant amount of student loans, and she was on a 30-year repayment plan. And then after that court ruling, it switched to a 10-year income-based plan. And I was wondering if I heard you right earlier that she may become eligible in the future to switch back to a 30-year repayment plan. And hers is specifically a public service plan for work at a hospital, if that is all adding up for you.
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, these are complicated things that you may not be able to give specific advice, but based on what you're seeing, what do you have for Josh?
Yeah, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program has two criteria, obviously being in the public service, but you've got to make qualifying payments. You've got to make 120 of these qualifying payments. And one of those types of qualifying payments would be under a standard 10-year repayment plan. Well, if you make payments for 10 years, your loan's going to be gone anyway. So you kind of, the other side of this is the income-driven repayment plan. So for the caller, if they're if anybody's interested in these public service loan forgiveness programs, they've got to be in one of these income-driven repayment plans to be able to benefit from it.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into one part of this we haven't talked about yet, Nick, when it comes to student loan delinquency and default. I want to get a listen to President Biden introducing the plan and talking about that part of it.
Normally, this could lead borrowers to fall into delinquency and default. But without their financial security, it would hurt their financial security, and that's not good for them or the economy. That's why we're creating a temporary 12-month, what we're calling on-ramp repayment program. Now, this is not the same as a student loan pause. It's been in effect for the past 3 years. Monthly payments will be due. Bills will not go out, and interest will be accruing. And during this period, if you can pay your monthly bills, you should. But if you cannot, if you miss payments, this on-ramp will temporarily remove the threat of default or having your credit harm, which can hurt borrowers for years to come.
Okay, so this big pause ends. Here's this on-ramp. How are you seeing that work, Nick?
Well, it's really a necessity to turn this pause back on, to end the pause. There's going to be a lot of disruption. I think that this on-ramp is going to at least help smooth some of that out. It has one complication, though, for policymakers who are interested in accountability. One of the major federal accountability tools is measuring and also sanctioning colleges according to how well their former students repay their loans. And if too many students fall into default, colleges can be sanctioned for that. And so what this on-ramp does is it helps people, which is the priority, and it makes it more complicated for these existing federal policy and accountability tools to really have an impact, because this means that, for the next 12 months and then even a year after that, we're not going to really see any delinquencies and default, which is a good thing, but it could be sort of hiding some of the underlying problems that we know exist in our higher education system.
What kind of numbers do we have, Nick, on how many people in Wisconsin are going to be affected by this this on-ramp concept?
Well, I don't have an exact number of people in Wisconsin who will be affected by it, but I do know this. There are about 700,000 total borrowers out there who will be affected one way or another. And that's about one in five adults or so. And they usually carry on average about $30,000 in student loan debt, sums up to about $22 billion. So it's a big, student loans are a big issue in the state of Wisconsin and nationally. In this on-ramp, it's going to benefit a sizable share of folks. There are going to be folks who aren't going to really need the on-ramp, and there are some who will really need it. And that's what it's there for, is just to help kind of with that transition to make sure that there's some flexibility in the system so that that borrowers can get back on their feet and make those payments.
Talking to Nick Hillman about student loan debt, a new repayment plan option coming from the White House. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is kind of specific, but I am a postdoctoral fellow, and I don't know if your guest is familiar with this situation, but essentially the granting agency pays the fellowship, and so I don't have employee status at the university that I'm essentially working for. So I've lost now 36 months of qualifying public service loan forgiveness payments despite essentially working full-time for university because of my non-employee status. So I've contacted my elected officials to kind of let them know about this like weird negative loophole, but I was wondering if your guest has any organizations that are kind of actively working on this in mind that I can contact just to really raise awareness about this problem.
Interesting, Angie. Thanks for the call. Nick, it is pretty specific. Anything you're seeing from the Biden administration on this or that you know is out there working on this?
A couple of organizations do come to mind, but I'm not sure if they will address this specifically. But one is the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the CFPB, a federal agency that is designed to just help address some of these issues. And another is a nonprofit organization that really sprung up over the recent years around debt cancellation, the Student Borrower Protection Center. And so possibly one of those organizations could not just help with this specific one, but anybody who's asked questions or who might have issues about their situations. It might be worth connecting with those groups.
Thanks a lot for that call. Woody joins us now in Green Bay. Woody, hi.
Yep. I feel that these people should not be forgiven a debt. Or how about the people that paid theirs off? Should they get a refund?
Woody, thanks a lot for the call. Again, getting back to, I think, the fairness issue, Nick, if someone has borrowed the same amount of money but paid it off, are they in effect being ripped off here?
You know, that's where this gets so politicized and understandably so. And it's not going to end with this Supreme Court decision. It's not going to end this election cycle. In fact, I would bet that the next election cycle, this whole debt cancellation is going to become a wedge issue. And so kind of buckle up for that, because it does speak to those issues of fairness. And at the same time, it speaks to the way that our states and our federal government support higher education or don't. Financially, there's a lot more burden on individuals to pay for college. And if we're expecting them to pay for college through student loans, our student loan system was basically designed in the 1960s and early 1970s, not for the issues that we're facing today. So there's sort of this clash of government, a clash of politics. And at the end of the day, it's affecting 44 million people. And so it's becoming just a really big issue.
Woody, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Nick, you're not a lawyer, but you dug deep into that Supreme Court decision that overturned the previous plan. Any hints as to whether this might be seen as more able to pass court muster than that other one?
That is the big question. In fact, I think one big hint is that already a group of senators and U.S. House members have put together a letter signed by 70 individuals. They're all Republicans who claim that the Department of Education and the Biden administration does not have authority to implement the SAVE program. And they've already invoked the Supreme Court decision, basically saying that the Department of Education has overstepped its authority, that if there were to be the kind of cancellation that the Biden administration has rolled out, then it has to have been legislated through congressional action. And so the question is whether congressional action is clear enough. And that's what we just saw with the Supreme Court decision. It wasn't clear enough. Here we go again. But in this case, I think it's probably a safer bet that this will pass and be able to proceed. But again, I'm not a lawyer. That's right. Just my two cents.
And Nick, just briefly, I asked you this last time too. Thoughts on, you know, making college more affordable in the first place so people don't rack up the debt in the first place?
You know, there are so many factors, but some big ones are, of course, tuition is expensive. And to keep tuition down at public institutions, that means that we have to have appropriations to cover that. So that's a big part. And it's been contributing to why students borrow, because college is more expensive in general. But it's not just tuition. It's also the cost of living, the housing and the food and other kind of necessities that it takes to be able to enroll in college and take time off of work if necessary, or care for childcare, you know. So all these things kind of add up, and those are things you're eligible to borrow student loans for. And so one of the big factors, I guess two of the big factors, are that college is expensive and so are the non-tuition expenses, but also family incomes have been just zapped. There's been a cliff in terms of that kind of growth that we've seen over time. And so families are more constrained today than before in many cases. So you have a lot of things happening that all contribute to steady and growing demand for student loans.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's Nick Hillman, professor at the UW-Madison Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis. We've been talking about the latest on student loans and President Biden's attempts to offer some loan forgiveness. Tomorrow here on Central Time, some federal health programs now require re-enrollment after a multi-year break. Find out who that affects and what you and loved ones need to know. That and more Monday here on Central Time.